Hello, this is Mike Harbath with this week's Shoot the Moon podcast, broadcasting live and direct from Revenue Rocket headquarters in Bloomington, Minnesota. And today I have my partner Ryan Barnett with me, and we are going to talk about how big a company can I afford to buy if I'm a buyer, and talk a little bit about how to evaluate the market in sort of this tumultuous time. As you know, Revenue Rocket is the world's premier growth strategy and M&A advisor to IT services companies, and we're going to share a little bit of that experience with you today. Over to you, Ryan.
Thanks, Mike. I like that the international theme to it. We're kicking off yet another non-US-based client here soon, and it's fun to do work around the globe. And I think our audience, hopefully, is around the globe as well. But today, kind of, Mike, you'd mentioned maybe what's a good number for a buyer to take a look at. I also want to examine the lens of what a seller should consider when evaluating buyers of their business. I think there's some surprising rules of thumb that we've seen that allow sellers to actually consider firms that are much closer to their revenue and their size than they imagine. So with that, I'd love to just kind of give us and set this up as the topic. When you look at buyers of IT services business, we typically group them into a few different categories. One is strategic, in which they're companies that are looking to grow their company through acquisition, get revenue targets, to get more geographic expansion, to get more service coverage with like-minded firms. And there's financial, typically we group in another group of financial buyers. They look through the lens a little bit differently. So when you're, as a seller, considering a financial buyer, it's going to be a bit different than with a strategic buyer. And with today's discussion, I'd actually like to start with some of those financial buyers that are out there, as it's a little bit different on how a seller should evaluate a financial buyer. And Mike, I'd like to get your input, and just, can you just help me understand the types of financial buyers that are out there?
Yeah, for sure. With the typical private equity buyer is either buying a platform or a tuck-in acquisition to a company that they already own a material stake in. And they're typically buying those businesses to hold them for up to 5 to 7 years and sell them for a profit. So it is certainly a relatively short term in the context of sort of a corporate lifetime of buy and hold strategy. And I guess you could even call it a buy and flip strategy, but you know, it's over 5-7 years typically. And so if you're a seller, you're going to want to understand, you know, some stuff about that, like how are they capitalized and do you fit the portfolio, what they want to buy, and, you know, kind of what's in it for you as it relates to if you're going to roll equity. They're usually going to ask you to roll some equity into the equity of that particular platform so that you can, as they say, the famous, you know, get the second bite of the apple. Also, there's, you know, family offices, right? Family offices operate a little differently. They look a lot like a private equity firm from an investment perspective. However, they usually buy all of your company. They don't ask you to roll equity. They usually are much more of a buy and hold type strategy. Many of them declare that they're buy and hold type buyers because they're actually buying the cash flow and the value of the cash flows over the long term, putting their capital to work to get a return on cash, if you will, or a return on capital. And IT services companies, if they're run well, tend to spin off a lot of cash. So it tends to be a pretty good investment over the long haul. And obviously, you know, we've talked about, you know, other flavors of buyers, but from a financial perspective, certainly financial buyers fall into those categories.
Yeah, and the other one we've seen a bit of is that I would call it a search funder, or someone who's looking for has got independent sponsors. It's a little different in that they're trying to build that and buy that business, but there's a category of individuals out there that are also interesting that fit, I think, a bit of a mix between a strategic and a financial buyer.
Yeah, good point, Ryan. I mean, you know, search funders come in all different shapes and sizes, everything from recent graduates from business school to people that have worked in, you know, the financial side of the industry, either for a PE firm or for an M&A broker, to people that come from industry who have been pretty successful in their own right, and then now they want to acquire business. And we've had a separate podcast, you know, about search funders in detail, so I'd encourage you guys to take a listen to that if you'd love to know, love to learn more about it.
So Mike, if we take the lens of a seller here, and a seller's looking they're willing to work with a financial buyer, what should they be looking for when it comes to the financial viability and hitting the number that they're looking for?
Well, certainly, you know, cash is king, right? So the financial buyer should be able to easily show capacity to do the deal. And a pitfall with financial buyers is some of them are independent sponsors looking to use your deal to raise capital. And that is a risk because they may not be able to raise the capital. They may or may not be able to raise the capital. But if you find that they're, quote unquote, an independent sponsor per se, and they want to sign you up to use you as bait for various private equity firms or other family offices or other investors, I would say seller beware, because the challenge, the risk you run in that case, the additional risk is that they can't raise the money. They don't have the committed capital, and that's going to be a problem. And so I think their track record, if you're going to sell to a financial buyer, is critically important. How many deals have they done, right, historically? How many deals have they done sort of in your industry, right, in IT services? Have they done any? Are you considered a platform or a tuck-in? How do those other sellers fare? And you should ask to talk to those people. And they do have to show a capacity for getting the transaction done. And generally that comes from a note from the people that are providing capital. Oftentimes, if it's a PE fund, they may, you know, be using both debt or leverage and cash from reserves to do the deal. And you know, you need to kind of understand what the source of funds are and get some confirmation that they can actually fund the deal. And we recommend, when we represent sellers, we do that early on in the process, so that you're not getting dragged around by, you know, either an independent sponsor or someone who's, you know, doesn't have the money. It's kind of a dreamer. And certainly asking those questions up front as qualifying questions is super important, and making sure that you get satisfactory answers to know if you're going to go into a diligence effort with them, that, it, you know, in the end, they can actually fund it.
So if I'm hearing that right, we want to look for words like committed fund, or if someone's on their fourth or fifth fund, and they have portfolio companies that are similar worth. That's going to be more. That's going to be better than someone who's looking to expand capital, or looking to use debt, or looking to use alternative means of financing other than what's already committed.
Yeah, absolutely. And why that's super important now is because, you know, with capital markets and the cost of capital going up, you know, it becomes tougher to get debt financing. Not certainly not impossible for these kinds of firms, because they have longstanding relationships with lenders, and they, you know, work it into their model. It certainly won't, I think, materially slow them down. We have a lot of reasons to think that certainly they could be some slowdown, and we've seen some already, although, you know, we've seen some high points where, you know, the market's picking back up, which, you know, again, sort of swings the pendulum maybe back the other way. But people that have experience in doing these deals, if they're a financial buyer, is really critical, because the way they fund them, the way they get committed capital, who they involve in the transactions, need to be partners with relationships that have been successful together. And certainly that can be vetted. prior to, getting down the track too far with them.
Great. No, thanks for defining that. If we switch to the other side, let's talk about strategic buyers for a bit. Mike, just wanted to define, just do your job, do a good job of defining a strategic buyer. And why do strategic buyers consider acquisitions?
Well, a strategic buyer in the traditional sense is one that generally is an operator of a business who's looking to grow through acquisition. And they're typically looking for very specific capabilities and or staff and or sort of geographic expansion opportunities or customer list expansion opportunities that will help them expand the business. And those buyers are different. And the reason I say that is because they're typically come at it much more with much more knowledge about the core, the levers to pull in IT services, right? The opportunity to grow. Most of these buyers will find you if you're a seller, because of your, what you built, right? They'll be looking specifically for you. Doesn't mean that, if you use a skilled and talented broker, that the broker can't find those strategics either, because they certainly do, and we do, as a matter of fact, every day on behalf of our clients. But it is someone who's operating a company in your space. In some ways, you could think of them as a competitor in some cases. Sometimes they're an adjacent business, meaning there's a it's a business line expansion for that acquirer. You're in an adjacency where either you both serve the same kind of customers with different service sets. We've certainly seen a lot of that in recent years. But there's someone who's going to buy and integrate and run your business without the goal of selling it or flipping it. It is, again, a buy and hold strategy, sort of long term, one in which the enhanced offering and team and staff are of huge value to growing the overall enterprise. Not just the value, and I don't mean to make this sound like it's not valuable. They certainly want the value of the cash flows as well, but it's far more than the value of just the cash flows.
When you think about this is the 1 + 1 = 3 type scenario.
Yep. Like you can cross sell and upsell into each other's customers. You can leverage, and I often use this analogy, like, a great strategic buyer allows you to go to a place that you can't get on your own, right? Just because they bring capabilities and synergies that you either it'll take you so long to build or so much investment to build that it's untenable, or it just because of the passage of time and the market opportunities, you wouldn't be able to capture it. Based on kind of where the market is today. So, it's certainly you can go together to a place you couldn't go apart, and that certainly adds a lot of value to the transaction.
So if you think about a strategic buyer, Mike, the their how do they typically fund a deal?
They'll typically fund a deal one of a couple ways. As you know, if you've listened to this podcast for any length of time, there's lots of currencies to be utilized in M&A transactions. Certainly, there's cash. There's earnout, which is really, a gain share, if you will, of where you take the business post-transaction. There's a seller note. As a seller, you can become the bank, if you will, and provide financing to the buyer. And those are, usually very effective, provided they're collateralized properly. And, there's outside debt financing as well as an equity role. So, debt financing, bank financing is a great source for strategics to utilize, and often many of them do. We have lots and lots of clients that we've helped buy companies over the years that have used debt financing successfully to acquire businesses. And then equity role really is about rolling at your equity into the bigger firm's combined entity equity. And again, this is not vastly different than in a private equity sort of environment. Basically, you're saying, hey, I want to be part of something bigger. I'm going to participate as a partner in that bigger entity. And, at some point when the larger entity is sold or has a liquidity event of some sort, let's call it a recapitalization with a private equity firm of their own relationship, that you will get essentially bought out or paid out of that equity.
That makes sense. So there's a variety of ways in which a firm can raise capital. As a seller, you have to evaluate the reasonable portions of which, and if you're selling in or selling out. I really encourage you listeners to listen to that podcast of if you're selling in, you may want those equity type opportunities. There's a lot of options there. If we think about really the size of a company, one of the things I think our sellers get surprised with is, and sometimes it's actually even the smaller companies get more surprised, is the size of the buyer. And Mike, can you, when companies are considering an acquisition, especially if it's supportive to be accretive to revenue and earnings, what is a buyer looking for as far as size? Relative to their own size. I mean, are buyers looking to chew off everything a little bit? Help me understand that.
Well, it's an interesting question because, certainly it has been a little bit all over the board historically for us. Like, we've helped individuals buy up to $15 million businesses, right? We certainly have helped sellers sell to companies of the same size or even just slightly larger than themselves. So I think you have to evaluate the situation. Each situation is a little bit different. When you look at access to capital, particularly on, I would say, on smaller transactions, and I would define smaller transactions as being, sort of under, $6, $7, $8 million in enterprise value. There is certainly a ton of financing sources available to any company, including the SBA, 7A loan program. There's loan limits and a few other things that go into place in the 7A loan program that move around a little bit. But we certainly had a lot of deals where we've represented sellers where the buyer is going to get and utilize an SBA 7A loan. And depending on the buyer's creditworthiness and sort of, personal net worth, they may be able to acquire a business just out of either retained earnings or their own investment capital, or a conventional loan from a bank or some combination. And so I wouldn't on its face as a seller rule out talking to someone who's interested in acquiring your business. It's just super important that you qualify sort of source of the funds that will be needed to do the deal. There might be a really great business case for you to merge with a company or be acquired by a company of the same size because there's this huge 1+1=3 upside opportunity. And if that buyer has access to capital, which you can confirm, then that shouldn't be a consideration. I know there's certainly a lot of assumptions to be made about, can that company afford to buy me if you're a seller? And you tend to rule out, well, they're too small or they're this or they're that. We don't think that's necessarily appropriate. We think it'd be appropriate to have a dialogue with them about how you feel about it, and talk to them about what is their plan to fund the transaction. Very directly. Certainly as a firm that hopefully you listen to this podcast for a while, if you're going to market to sell your business, you've hired a competent broker to represent you. And better yet, maybe you've hired us. I don't know, but in all seriousness, that broker is going to be able to qualify that buyer on your behalf, to make sure that those, the access to that capital exists. Sometimes that can be a little bit of a tricky conversation if you're doing it on your own behalf with, say, a peer organization or someone that might be considered a competitor. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think whether it be a someone the same size or even smaller, or maybe even an individual, we've seen certainly individuals who have been operating executives that all have all the skills needed to build and grow a business who want to be business owners, you know, raise capital. They've, you know, used some of the provisions in the 401k laws to, you know, have leverage their investment portfolio to kind of pay the down payment for, you know, loan programs to acquire businesses. And there's just a ton of ways that individuals that have a little bit of access to capital can use a combination of cash and leverage to buy your firm in its entirety. Or maybe you want to be a partner and merge with them and swap equity. All of those things are certainly viable options.
I think that that's a great point. And one of the things, if it's not clear through this, is that buyers are going to, it's tough to do an acquisition. And if you're buying any firm, there's a fair amount of work and due diligence and strategy that's needed in order to successfully complete an acquisition. And so if that's the case, you're going to try to want to take the biggest bite that you can. And if, and try to be a big swing. I think sellers really struggle to understand that concept that if you're a really tiny fish and you're swimming in a pond full of sharks, you're not going to be big enough to gather the attention and find the strategic value that's needed. So having someone a little closer to you in size can actually be a much better fit than someone that is a behemoth in the industry.
Yeah, and I would also add that, you know, it's a risk mitigation play for that buyer, right? And yeah, they're going to take on some risk. But maybe you're going to take on some risk as a seller too, particularly if there's an earnout or a seller note involved. But in the end, you know, a combined company, especially if ones are of similar size, are going to be further, further fortified against, ups and downs of the market. The larger the combined business is, the more, like I often use the term, thick ice you have to be able to weather, you know, the storms and also take advantage of, you know, upside potential in the market. It just is factual. So, you know, being part of something bigger, even if it's just something that's maybe twice your size, once you combine, you know, 1 + 1 = 3 will, be a risk mitigation strategy in its own right.
Good. Well said. If I was to kind of summarize the discussion here today, if you're looking at a financial buyer, the size of the acquisition is often going to be determined by the size of the fund and access to capital, which is can be, I think, a little bit more blunt. And as a reminder to sellers, many funds will talk about their investment criteria. And it really helps to understand if you fit within that, you know, within that target, whether too big or too small, I think is critical. Establishing proof of funds within those, and making sure that the fund is well done, I think is critical as well. The other portion, if you're considering a strategic buyer, they can often be similar to your size. And especially if you're looking to grow in and sell in, it's critical to understand that someone near your size may be much better than someone that's 10 times your size. As they've got that 1 + 1 = 3, that really helps move the lever on the accretive to earnings and accretive to revenue side. With that, Mike, anything else you'd like to cover?
No, I think, you know, when you think about it, it's somewhat counterintuitive, that you know, firms of similar sizes are much more likely bedfellows, so to speak, than ones that you know, maybe someone's 10 or 20 or 30 times your size looking to buy you. The acquisitions are hard, right? To your point, Ryan, to get done. They're very challenging to get done. It's just as hard to get a very small deal done as it is to get a larger deal done. You know, if someone's going to make the investment in the resources needed to get that transaction done, and you know, brokers and broker fees and legal and finance and tax support and all stuff is needed as a buyer, they want to buy as large a firm as they can to really, you know, make to leverage that investment. And versus you might think, well, you know, maybe a company would buy a firm a tenth of the size or smaller all the time because they want kind of a low risk play. And that is a consideration for some buyers, but I would tell you it's much more likely that a buyer of any size wants to buy the largest firm they can in order to get the most leverage against the investment that's needed just around the mechanics to get the deal done. And so, you know, don't, if you're a seller, don't be put off by that or turn those deals away. I don't think if that makes sense. I think it makes sense for you to look at them and qualify them carefully.
Well said. Well said. Well, Mike, that's all I have the questions for you today.
All right, great. With that, we'll tie a ribbon on it for this week at Revenue Rocket. And with this podcast, we encourage you to tune in next week, where we'll talk about more exciting topics around growth strategy and buy-side and sell-side M&A for IT services companies. Thanks, and make it a great week.